Okay, it's good to be back. We missed, I think, only 1 week or 2 weeks. I can't remember on my travel. But we're going to have a two-part series now on Purim. The Wednesday closest to Purim. I'm actually going to be traveling again for a very short trip, but I will be traveling again. That's why we're doing the two-part series on Purim now. Then there'll be a week before Purim. And then after we come back from Purim, we'll get started. Got to come in this world. And there's source sheets also, Esther. I know you want source sheets. Anyway, then we'll have, I'm not sure if we'll do a miscellaneous topic before Pesach, or we'll just dive into a pre-Pesach series. But either way, today we begin a two-part series on Purim, and today's shiur is going to be about philosophical, spiritual, hashkafic ideas relating to Purim, and next week will be related to halachos. Last year for the pre-Purim shiur, we only did one, I checked my notes. And we did a one shiur before Purim, and it was like a halachic overview. We went over all the four mitzvot of Purim in general, and specifically how they related to women. So I don't think that we'll do that shiur again, although maybe I can share the link. I was actually thinking of picking a single halachic topic for next week and maybe doing a deep dive on that. I was actually thinking of maybe doing something provocative, like why don't we have a women's Megillah reading in Kilat Ha'Elah? Would that be an interesting topic? Or should I shy away from that? Oh, I should, okay. I wasn't sure people would react to that. Okay. You don't even know what I'm going to say yet. Okay, fair. Anyway, so maybe we'll do something like that next week. Stay tuned. Okay, anyway, for today, if we have time, I prepared three different ideas. It's a very full double side, two sheets, but it's really only three ideas. And the reason is because the first idea, the first source, is the entire front page, the entire first page. I wasn't expecting it to be this way, but I came across this beautiful idea in the introduction to the book Darash Moshe. Darash Moshe is the book of Rav Moshe Feinstein's ideas on the Chumash and on holidays and things like that. Rav Moshe Feinstein, of course, was most well known, and his legacy certainly and contribution that will be remembered in 100 years and in 1,000 years was as a halachist and the premier posek of the 20th century, or certainly the second half of the 20th century for sure. And yet, he was a giant, and he was actually great in the drush area. I wouldn't call him a parshan, but he is very, very good on Chumash, and I happen to be a big fan of this Sefer. And an introduction to the Sefer, Darash Moshe, which I think was written by grandchildren, but they quote this, you know, this is their notes or somebody's notes, but it's presented in the first person as if Moshe was speaking. This is an idea apparently that they heard that he said, which they use as the introduction to the whole Sefer. But as it so happens, it's actually a very, very beautiful idea which is relevant throughout the year, but it's anchored by a number of actually very interesting Purim ideas. So it ended up being so beautiful, I actually gave you almost the entire piece, which is why it takes up an entire front page of the source sheet. So we're definitely going to go through the whole thing because I can't leave out any of it. It's too good. And that would be like asking me, as Rabbi Lam once said to me, about editing yourself, like doing surgery on yourself without anesthesia. It's just too painful. I can't leave any of it out. But time permitting, the second sheet has two ideas. One very short one, a Hasidic idea from B'nai Yisachar. And if we have even more time, a very nice idea about Amalek and Parshat Zachor from Rav Asher Weiss. So hopefully we'll get through all of this. But if not, at the very least, let's start with the first idea. Again, this is the front page of the sheet. And the title that I put on the sheet is a beautiful Purim Torah, and I put Purim Torah in quotes because, as many of you know, that is a phrase that we banty about. Purim Torah, the way it's colloquially used, is a little bit of a leitzanus. That is to say, you know, on Purim, you may have heard, sometimes people drink too much, and they come up with all sorts of funny, wacky Torah ideas. And that is sometimes then done even when they don't drink, and not on Purim. So because people say all sorts of wacky ideas and it's fun and it's in good spirit of the day at the Purim Suda, so when you sometimes say ideas like that in general, people refer to that as, oh, that's just Purim Torah. And that's not always the best compliment for an idea, all right? But in this case, this is actually beautiful Purim Torah. Okay, so that's my, you see how much thought went into even that three-word title, ladies? Do you see what I do for you? Okay, so that is the, the very broad and non-specific, but I thought clever, title of the source sheet. But here we go. This is, again, from the Sefer Darash Moshe of Moshe Feinstein, the introduction. And he begins, as I say, a very broad introduction, which is about Torah and Jewish life in general, but asking a very simple question about something that is completely overlooked. It's so technical, it's so basic, it's so, from foundational to the holiday that we don't even think about it, which is, where does the name of Purim come from and why is it significant? Says Rav Moshe, first line, first paragraph. Tzarech lehavin, shem Purim. So So where does that come from? We know. Shekaru al shem hapur, right? A pur is a lot, right? The lottery. Haman made a lottery. He wanted to kill the Jews. What day will it be? He didn't make a decision based on thoughtful, you know, analysis of this or that. He did a lottery and it came out in Adar. And because he did a lottery, and that's called a pur, so the holiday is called Purim. Right? Whoever thinks about that, we don't even think about it. But if you think about it for a half a second, says Rav Moshe, it's absurd. That's how you come up with a name for the holiday? Because, I mean, first of all, it's from Haman wanting to kill us, and it's the most incidental thing. Like, why is that relevant? As he says, where it's underlined, Hashem tzarich leharot ikar hanes. Right? You would think that they'd pick a name for the holiday that represents the essence of the holiday, the essence of the miracle. Well, Mashi peel pur lo nira ikar hanes, right? To put it mildly. It doesn't seem like the fact that Haman used a lottery to figure out what day to kill the Jews, that is somehow the essence of the whole holiday. That's why we're picking. It doesn't make any sense. So the Gemara itself, he says, second line, the Gemara itself, Daf Yud Gimel Amud Beis, tells us in Megillah, Shahaman Sameach al Shenafal Pur Ba'Adar. Right? When it came out in Adar, he was very, very excited. Mishum Shemes Moshe. Because he knew the tradition was, this is our tradition, right? That Moshe's died, Moshe's Yortzeit, not on the 13th or the 14th, but Moshe's Yortzeit was on the 7th of Adar. So because the extermination date was going to be on in the month of Adar, he was very excited. Because that's when Moshe died. It's a bad omen for the Jews. If Moshe died in Adar, that's bad for the Jews. This is good for him. But as the Gemara points out, La Yada Shagam Nolad Ba'Adar. Right? Moshe was actually born and died on the same day. So he was also born in Adar. So it's not necessarily only a bad day for us. Adar is a good day, a good month for us. But says Moshe, again, L'chora Enu Vankokach. Like, what's going on here? Like, why do we care so much? Like, would the story have been any different if we would have been destined to be killed in Nisan or Iyar? The month is not really relevant to the story at all. Moreover, how Haman chose the date doesn't seem to also doesn't seem to be such a big deal. It's such a big deal, that's where the name of the holiday comes from. It seems to be quite lagging. Right, Sukkot is because Hashem gave us a sukkah to protect us in the desert. Pesach, because he passed over our houses in the death of the firstborn. Those are essential characteristics of the story. The lottery, Purim, it's just weird. Something's amiss. That's Rav Moshe's question. Now, based on that very technical, almost pre-question of like the most basic things about Purim, just even the name, where it comes from, why we care about this. So we're going to get back to that at the end of the piece. But Rav Moshe uses this to launch into, again, it's hard to say it's the most profound, but one of the more profound ideas. I'm not even saying it's a chiddush, but he expresses it in such a simple but beautiful and straightforward way. He uses this as a springboard to discuss what he thinks is one of the foundational hashkafos, you know, approaches to life of Judaism, and specifically how it is different than non-Jews. And he doesn't ever use the word Catholicism, but it's hard to believe, especially with his background and even some of the language he does use, that he's not talking about the Catholic Church as a contrast, as a foil to Yiddishkeit. Second paragraph. So how do I explain this? So we're going to zoom out for a while away from Purim, but we'll get back to it. Hine, when it comes to the non-Jews, ha'umas ha'olam be'emunoseim ha'havalim, ma'aminim shi'esh, b'nei, that's a typo, I'm sorry, b'nei adam kidoshim. They believe that there are certain people, i.e. the priest, right, who are inherently, or the pope, who are inherently holy. Sha'komrim, that the priests, shalahem, Yesh lehem machmazel levushim acherim v'asur lisa isha chodom. Right, that's why the priest, or for that matter, the nun, right, they have completely different clothing, and they're not allowed to get married. They have to be celibate because they view these people as somehow intrinsically holy or completely different than the rest of the religion, the rest of the people, than the masses. Ulevad shehu sheker, says Rav Moshe Feinstein, he ain't mentioned any words. He says this in addition to the fact that this is simply wrong, incorrect theology. But more than that, hum kalkel ma'od. This approach to religion, he says, is incredibly damaging. And he makes a number of points. Number one, shaharei, second line. Kevan shehem kedoshim yoter me'acherim, yecholim hamon am lomar, shelachem tzrichim heim l'kayim ha'mitzvot. Aval ha'pshutim heim kebali chayim shirashayim lasot ma'ashalibam chafetz. Number one, this is his most profound point, is if there's this holy man, or for that matter, holy woman, and then there's the rest of us, so who really, really needs to follow the laws and follow the rules of God or their mitzvos. It's easy, certainly subconsciously, for them to assume that what really counts is not what they do or don't do. What really counts is whatever whether it's the Pope or the local priest or nun or whoever the religious leader is, what they do is what matters. Because they're the holy ones, they're the leaders. And what we do doesn't really matter. We could do whatever we want. We're free to do whatever we want. The chain, a second residual or related point, im komar echad marshia. Again, this is, who knows what Rav Moshe had in mind, but in light of some of the things that have come out, certainly in recent years in the Catholic Church, this is like eerie. But he says, again, I'm not picking on Catholics per se, because I don't think it's limited to them, but I have a feeling that is who Rav Moshe was talking about. He says, let's say a particular priest sins, right? When they fall short, right? And needless to say, he'll get to Jewish rabbis and leaders falling short. Don't worry, he's going to get to that. There's no rug that we're sweeping anything under in this piece, but he's still going to point out a big difference. But when it comes to someone in the Catholic Church or in their religion, if the leaders fall short, so if everything is about the leader and the Pope or the priest, etc., so number one, why do I have to do anything? It's really all that matters is what he or she does. But number two is, and if they do things that are not right, well, apparently then there's nothing wrong with me doing that either. And the thing which we have seen, and unfortunately the church has seen in recent years, everything is based on the leader. It's all powerful, right? So it creates cynicism, right? That's why their churches are empty now, unfortunately, right? I'm not dancing on their graves. I don't think there's any reason for us to celebrate the fact that in Europe in particular, but even in America, churches are emptier and emptier. Certainly the Catholic churches, for sure. They have major, major problems in numbers. And there's no question that part of that, in general, the world's gotten much more secular, which is definitely not a good thing. But also it's because they've seen the hypocrisy and other things that have come out of the church. Is that even a question? And says Rav Moshe, all of this is exacerbated and almost inevitable based on their whole worldview, which they created this false illusion of the priest or the Pope and other people being somewhat holy and different, which already created this completely, in essence, it doesn't matter what they say from the pulpit, but it's basically creating a license for the people, A, to live a secular lifestyle, because after all, as long as I go to, they believe in a vicarious kind of a religion. Right? As long as the Pope or the priest is, or the nun is doing the right thing, or the religious leader, the reverend is doing the right thing, then it doesn't matter. And moreover, of course, when they see their leaders actually failing, so that can have one of two, and it could have both, frankly, deleterious effects. A, they're more heter to themselves, right? If the priest did something wrong, so I can do it too. It can't really be that bad. And number two is, of course, it creates a certain level of cynicism, and it's hard to just uphold the whole religion. I'm still in that second paragraph. Now we're in the underlying part. Aval Torah Hakadosha Amra Mishpat Echad L'Chol Adam. Judaism has a completely different perspective. We have, for lack of a better term, a much more democratic approach. All men are created equal. And he's paraphrasing the pasuk. This is not the way the pasuk is actually read, but the phrase Mishpat Echad is to say there's one law for everybody. We don't believe in this hierarchy. Mishum she'ain, and this is an incredible line. If I had a highlighter, I'd be highlighting this. Mishum she'ain klal adam echad kadosh be'etzem echaviro. Judaism does not believe that any single person is more intrinsically holy than any other. We are all created equally. Now, parentheses or pause for a moment. Does that mean that there's no such thing as greatness? Does that mean that there's no such thing as a gadol, a tzaddik? Of course that says Rav Moshe, but that's a meritocracy. No one is born inherently better than each other. Rather, Ella, end of the line, mitzad gadluso b'torah. Yeah, of course, if a person works on him or herself, learns a lot of Torah, does a lot of mitzvos, yes, they can make themselves better, not innately, but through their behavior, through their moral choices, through their piety. Of course, people can live better and more elevated and more successful lives than any other, right? It's not socialism. We don't believe in equality of result. That is definitely not a Jewish idea, right? How much effort you put in, and the results will be what the results will be. But the equality of opportunity, that idea that, again, you don't need to go to any American document, that all men are born equal, and everyone is innately with the same Tzelem Elokim, and with the same soul, and the same Kedusha, the same sanctity, says Rav Moshe, that is a Jewish idea, Mishpat Echad. We are all the same. Aval kol ha'olam, he says, next line, af Moshe Rabbeinu alav ha'shalom, hu yalud isha, kechol adam, v'tzarech l'kol tzarechei adam, kechol adam. Says Rav Moshe, it's more than that. It's not just that we're all equal. We're all flesh and blood. Even the greatest of the great, Moshe Rabbeinu, how was he born? Now, clearly, what is Rav Moshe Feinstein here, right, implicitly rejecting? Immaculate conception. We reject that. We don't believe in that. Moshe was born out of a physical union between a man and a woman, no different than anybody else, says Rav Moshe Feinstein. And he needed, other than, I'll add, when he was on Har Sinai for 40 days, that was like kind of miraculous, but he needed, says Rav Moshe, he needed to eat, he needed to sleep. Rav Moshe also, again, Moshe Rabbeinu, and we know this was so atypical that even his brother and sister, Aaron and Miriam, were upset by this. But Moshe Rabbeinu did not have a typical married life. He had an abbreviated married life. But there at least was a period, even in Moshe's life, where he was married, he fathered children, he was the product of a physical relationship between a husband and a wife. That is what Judaism believes. No one is innately holy, no one is born miraculously. Not only that, even when it's Moshe, Ein lo shum dinim acherim mikol adam, there are no separate rules. Yeah, Moshe has to keep kosher, you don't. Moshe puts on tefillin, you don't. No, everyone has the same laws. V'ga'on, v'ish pashut, mamish shavim hein. Right, this could have been taken, l'havdil, from almost any great American speaker or political thinker or Western political thinker in the last 200 years. You can't say it better than this. The greatest of the great, the biggest genius, or the simplest person, says Rav Moshe, are totally equal. Imkain lomed mehagadol kol adam, and therefore, when we see other great people, we learn from them. Umevin kol achad shekam hu yachol yod gadol b'torah b'tzadik adam hagadol shamakir kevshu adam pashut kamahu v'igiel shlemut. And what is the benefit of this? So there are numerous obvious benefits, but what's the first word Moshe says? He thinks from an educational and inspirational perspective, this is far more empowering. And far more powerful. Because it's not, again, he's not saying that we should look at everyone as equal at the in their current state. I look at certain people, look how much Torah they know. They know more Torah than me. Look at this person, he or she is so much more righteous than me. They do so much more chesed than me. I struggle to concentrate in davening, and this person next to me is davening seemingly with such fervent kavana. There are differences, and there are people who are doing better, so to speak, than others. None of this was to deny that. Right? We live in a culture right now where there's a tremendous dumbing down. Right? Everyone gets the participation trophy. That's not what Rav Moshe is saying. There could be a champion of davening. There could be, again, I'm not saying you should lord it over anyone. Rav Moshe wasn't saying that either. But he's not denying that there could be greatness or excellence, maybe is the better word. Of course there's excellence. But everyone started off equal. Everyone starts off with the same innate potential and sanctity and dignity. And therefore, says Rav Moshe, one of the numerous benefits of that is that when you then correctly, and you should identify, yeah, he or she is better than me, is more excelling more than me, is accomplishing more than me, is doing more than me. But that, instead of saying what you might otherwise naturally want to say, which is, well, of course, because he or she was born holy. That's not expected of me. Which is this kind of hierarchical, you know, differentiation that you might have in another religion. But from a Jewish perspective, no, once I realize that this person, right, is actually born the same way as I was, with the same innate sanctity, the same flesh and blood, this also has to sleep, also has to eat, and yet lifted him or herself up, that should empower and motivate me to be even greater. I just came back from a trip interviewing and testing boys, you know, hopefully to come to yeshiva next year. And one of the things that comes up often when I'm testing boys is that one of the great opportunities you have, maybe it's true in every yeshiva, but it certainly would be true with the yeshiva where I'm lucky enough to teach, is that I tell them, especially since some of the boys I'm interviewing are quite gifted, but I said, it doesn't matter who you are now, trust me, when you get to our base medrash, there will be people who know even more than you, and are even smarter than you, but the ones who are successful are because dafka, that is an incredible motivating factor. It empowers them. You will see kids from the same kind of background as you, whether they're Israelis or Americans, who are perhaps learning even more or doing even better, and you will have that moment. You'll say, well, if he can do it, then why can't I? You'll see that student who's only a year ahead of you. You may have even known him in high school. You may have gone to camp with him. And all of a sudden, wow, he can learn this many hours a day, or he can accomplish that. He's no different than I. We went to the same camp. went to the same high school. We learned the same things. So says Rav Moshe, that little example that I'm giving in a microcosm, in a yeshiva environment, is really true for all of us in life. Because we believe, again, but it's all based on what foundation, says Rav Moshe? This Jewish belief, which is very much in contradistinction with the non-Jewish belief that he was talking about, that really everyone is created innately equal. And therefore we have the ability to grow and should be motivated and inspired to try to, in our own way, do the same things that other great people have already done, because in essence, in deepest part of our souls, we're the same as they are. In the next paragraph, I'll say this more outside just for the sake of time, but it's a really very powerful idea. And he points out that we know in the census, right? Parsha Shkolim is this week, and the Torah talks more than once about a census, right? How they used to count the Jewish people. So the term that is used is Tisa. So why is the term Tisa used in the context of counting? So he points out, this is not his translation, but Tisa means to elevate, to lift up. And he explains that the census that was done for the Jewish people, again, you cannot think of a more technical, boring, technocratic kind of thing, you know, a census, right? Whoever thought of the census when you fill that out every 10 years or whatever it is, you have to fill the census out, that's somehow a great inspirational, educational, religious moment, the census? Says Rav Moshe, in Judaism, yes. Why? Because how did we pay, right? Everyone gave the same half a shekel. And as says Rav Moshe, when we're counting, we don't count, you know, you don't get extra points because you were a bigger tzaddik. Everybody is equal in the census, right? We count everybody because everybody counts. And that's actually a powerful, powerful message. Says Rav Moshe, so many people, and this is really, really powerful, and as you know from past Shurim, when I get very excited, I play with Word, Microsoft Word, and I did a double underline. You can only imagine. This was being done around 1:30 in the morning last night, so you can imagine how excited I was. Alone in my office, downstairs, quiet. Oh, how can I express how much I love this Dvar Torah? A double underline, Microsoft Word. This is what the rabbi does when he's wild and crazy. Okay, so I double underline that. What does Rav Moshe say? He says, so many times. Again, this is so powerful for every mother, for every teacher, for every father. It says, so many times people sin, but what's the root cause of their sin? The chait is humility. The sin was humility. Humility, a sin? How could humility be a sin? Isn't humility the greatest thing? And we've given previous shiurim on the importance. We had a whole shiur on the mitzvah of anava. But yes, not if it's abused. Like everything, you can misuse or abuse something. Says Rav Moshe, if your humility is telling you, I don't have to or I can't, like him or her, so then we give ourselves all sorts of license to do less, to do bad, whatever, because I'm not that person. That is, as he put it, chotei b'midat ha'anava. Our false humility is causing us to sin. We have to remember, I count just as much as Moshe Rabbeinu count. We're all one person in the same census. And therefore, he says at the end of the paragraph, mitromeim ha'adam bazeh, a person, if they think about it and they internalize the lesson of how Jewish people are counted, they'll be elevated and inspired by that. And that's the idea of tisa. V'yilmad ne'hagadol, v'yikineu kiras ofrim, and then you will have appropriate admiration. Judaism, in general, it's one of the Ten Commandments, right? Don't covet. But it's very clear if you read the psukim, right? Don't covet, don't be jealous of other people's material possessions. Right? Those are the examples that are given in the Ten Commandments. But the Gemara says very clearly, you should... Yes, that's what Moshe, he says. Kinas Ofrim, next words. He says, but you are supposed to admire and be jealous of people's spiritual and moral accomplishments. Not jealous as in you're angry or, you know, petty about it, but jealous in the sense of if they have it, I want it too. Just like a person is jealous of his neighbor's car, so that means you don't want them to have the car, right? There are people who don't want their neighbors to have the car, but that's not jealousy, that's a different midah. Jealousy is I want the car too. So that's a bad midah. That's what's in the Ten Commandments. Don't be jealous and want other people's houses, or you think their marriage is better than yours, or they have more money than you. That's what you're not supposed to be jealous of. But you see someone else who is genuinely, you know, accomplishing more in a moral and a spiritual way, you should be jealous, i.e. you should want it for yourself. Yes, just like my neighbor can go to Daf Yomi, just like my neighbor goes to a shir every week, just like my neighbor does chesed every week, just like my neighbor seems to daven well, just like my neighbor is da-da-da-da. Okay, yes. So says Rav Moshe, that's the whole idea of a census. Look around. We're all equal. We count everyone because everyone counts. And that itself should inspire you. Next paragraph. We're on the fourth paragraph here. Another benefit of this, and here is where he's clearly coming back to what he had said previously about what he was calling non-Jews, and I'm saying, I think he's clearly referring to the church. And that is, he says, "V'yesh to'eles af she'ira chas v'shalom sh'adam gorol ha'torah yasur miderach ha'torah." And this is where I said before, Rav Moshe, even though he was harping on the fact that the non-Jewish priests and the church, that they have all their problems, but he wasn't going to sweep our shmutz under the rug. Rav Moshe is not denying that there can be people who have great prestige and power in the Jewish world who also turn out to have been very, very flawed and have disappointed us and have done wrong. However, says Rav Moshe, if way before leader X or Y has been found out, unfortunately, to be a problematic, scandalized personality, if way before that we had the proper approach to what it means to be great, then even though it'll be disappointing, obviously, and it could be painful, obviously, and a given community might have to make certain structural changes, obviously, in terms of who their leadership is, but it shouldn't necessarily be a theological crisis. If it's a crisis of faith that leaders have failed, it means what? That way before they failed, or way before we knew their failures, we put too much confidence in them. If you held them up, Merosh, as some quasi-divine, super-spiritual demigod better than you, representative of God walking on this earth, and then they fail, you've invested so much in that person, that's really a crisis of faith. But if you realize that they were always just, as he said before, like Moshe Rabbeinu, Yalud Isha, no different than you, innately, and just like they have to eat and sleep, that means they also have a Yetzer Hara, and they also have weaknesses. Now, it's true, it's incredibly disappointing if it turns out that they were not only better than us, but maybe even worse than us at controlling that Yetzer Hara. And if they used to espouse certain things which they clearly weren't living, so the hypocrisy also makes things worse. Ramosha's not denying any of that. But none of that, again, this wouldn't take away from the pain of a community, you know, being disappointed and let down by a leader. I don't think he's denying that, and it would be obvious that that's all true. But the pain, the disappointment, does not necessarily a theological crisis make. And yet there are times where you do have these major crises of faith. It says, Ramosha, it's only because they made a more basic mistake. And that is the community stopped believing in Hashem and was believing in the man. We believe in Hashem. We don't believe in people. So Rav Moshe makes this point very powerfully in that paragraph, that even if people fail, which they do, we don't necessarily have a crisis of faith or throw off our connection to Torah. Because the real thing is the Torah. The chol gadlusu hu mitzad haTorah. V'sha'azav derech haTorah shoveinu nechshav. Right? So this person, when they were the embodiment of Torah, I respected them. And if it turns out that they're not the embodiment of Torah, I don't respect them. You know, again, I don't think Ramosha would disagree with anything I'm saying, but I'm being a little more expansive than Ramosha is saying. He's kind of making it very simple. Yeah, what's the big deal? So it turns out the leader was a failure. Find another one. Like, I don't think he really thinks it's that simple. But philosophically, it is that simple, says Ramosha. If it was always about the Torah, so this person isn't living up to it. It's not the problem that, so you always believed in the Torah, you just thought that this person embodied the Torah. Now that you find out this person didn't embody the Torah, so you move on. But it's much harder, you know, in real life than it would be the way he's making it. But again, it's still important to realize that he's right. And that it all starts with where we were beforehand, right? Again, not that long ago, it wasn't this piece, it wasn't with Purim, but it was a year or two ago. Well, first of all, the whole Israel and the whole Jewish people, but Israel in particular, was torn apart last year by the Chaim Walder affair. And I spoke about it in the shul, I spoke about it for our women's shiur. I also was brought in and twice spoke about it in America. And there's no question that a lot of the pain in that particular story was clearly he had been held up way too high to begin with. But it's not only that. One of the communities that I spoke in years before that, a very, very leading shul rabbi in that community had, shall we say, been found wanting in one of the other of the Ten Commandments, not the don't covet one, although he might have also been coveting someone else's wife too, which is what made him violate one of the other Ten Commandments. It was, I know people from that, right? Very, very, and people without, no one mentioned a single name, but it was clear even some of the questions people were asking me, they're still traumatized by that from years before. Or, not that long ago, I can't remember how many years it was, but since I lived in Israel, there was someone who lived not that far from here, who had been one of the most prominent seminary teachers for decades, had done horrible, horrible things to I don't know how many people, right? So the pain like is obvious, and the disappointment, the Chil Hashem, but it doesn't have to be a crisis of faith. Now, but the answer is, but it was for many people. But so, for Moshe, who was probably the, from what I understand, maybe even like the nicest person ever, he wouldn't have said this in a cruel way. And I still don't mean this, God forbid, in an uncaring or unsympathetic way. But if we want to take a step back and be more objective about the situation, the reason it wasn't just disappointing or painful or embarrassing, but a crisis of faith, was because they had made a mistake way before. They had put their faith in that person. And we don't believe in people, we believe in Hashem. We believe in the Torah. To the extent that somebody embodies the Torah, so we respect that person. But it turns out that they don't represent the Torah, so that we don't respect that person. Now again, I'm reiterating, I understand on a human level this would be... I've had people that I thought were good people who I turned out were not. I personally have never had a Rebbe or a role model of mine do that on any level like that. So I'm lucky. So anyone who did, I'm sympathetic to. You know, if this is your main teacher, your main Rebbe, your shul rabbi, the person who married you. Can you imagine being someone who, this was the person who married you under the chuppah, and it turns out they weren't so good at that part of their life? Not a simple thing. I'm not denying that. Neither would Ramosha. But philosophically, it shouldn't be the same thing as if you thought they were innately holy, if you thought they were God on earth, if you thought that you believed in them, yeah, that's a crisis of faith. But says Ramosha, I guess if I could, I would say he's espousing old school non-Hasidic approach. Ramosha was not a Hasid, right? I'll editorialize for only a millisecond, right? Much of the world has become very Hasidic. Even the Litvisha world, we've turned Rabbanim into Rebbes. So I come from Hasidic stock, so I don't want to say anything irreverent about Hasidus, but clear of Moshe is taking a very non-Hasidus approach. And I think it's very, very healthy in many ways. Okay, he mentions an idea, I'll just say it outside again, because it's another Purim idea, which is also very interesting. And then he says in the name of the great Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky. He says, Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky asked a question, which is very interesting. I never thought about this, or maybe because I assumed something. You'll tell me if you agreed with me or not, but apparently at least it's not so clear as I thought, which is, when we talk about how Mordechai didn't bow down to Haman, right? We read about this every year, Mordechai didn't bow down, and Haman gets very insulted, and even though he had all the power in the world, but he had an ego, and he wanted to, right? But he didn't just want to kill Mordechai, he wanted to kill the whole Jewish people, right? He then said, oh, Mordechai's Jewish, I want to kill all of them. Well, why do you want to kill all of them? What's the connection? Now, we just say, oh, because he's an anti-Semite. But Cheskel Abramsky was not satisfied with that answer. And he assumed, and I have to say, Leah, maybe you'll tell me if there's a medrash I'm not remembering, or maybe it's even more embarrassing, a pasuk I'm not remembering. I always assumed, I don't know why, but I just always assumed, that all the other Jews were bowing down. Is that clear? Anywhere? Because Cheskel Abramsky clearly assumes that the Jews weren't bowing down either. Right? Maybe it's conflicting evidence? Okay, good. So, that's why I turned to my ex. Right, I even texted someone at 1:30. You know, I have friends in America, luckily. So, like at 2:30 in the morning, I was preparing this. I could text them. You know, I said, am I forgetting a Gemara or a Medrash? I just always assumed that everyone else was bowing down, and only Mordechai didn't bow down. Maybe that's what my kindergarten teacher told me. I don't remember why I thought this.
If you look very closely at the text of the Malbim,
okay, therefore that implies what?
So that only would apply to
a... Certain, right. Okay, so but my assumption, which I don't know, maybe, am I the only one who always assumed that everyone else was bound down? Or am I the only one who assumed that? Other people assume that too? Okay, so it might, I'm not saying it's not true, but apparently it's not as clear as my subconscious had always told me. And Rabbi Cheskel Abramsky says, he doesn't assume that everyone would bow down at all. Why do I mention that? Because he says that's why Haman raged against the Jews. That is to say, he suggests that why did Haman want to kill Mordechai? Not because he didn't bow down. He figured eventually he'd be able to force Mordechai to bow down. Right? A powerful person would certainly easy to understand, easy for us to imagine that an egotistical and such a person with such power like Haman, he figured eventually, okay, Mordechai didn't bow down today, he didn't bow down yesterday, but I'll eventually get him to bow down. But why did it matter? Because Cheskel Abramsky assumes no one else is bowing down yet, but he figured once Mordechai will bow down, and I'll get him eventually, then all the other Jews will follow him and they'll bow down also. Or I shouldn't say, actually, I said it wrong. All the other people who are descendant or the same nation as Mordechai will. But once, says Mordechai Skabramsky, he realized, no, Mordechai is Jewish. The Jewish people aren't like the non-Jews. Just because, even if their leader does a sin and bows down, they'll know. Just because our leader sin doesn't mean we have to sin. And he ties this into the whole idea that we've been saying until now. You take that Catholic or Christian or non-Jewish approach, well, if the leader does something wrong, then I guess either I can be cynical about the whole religion, or if he did it, I can do it. But that's not the Jewish approach. The Jewish approach is we don't believe in people, we believe in the Torah, we believe in Hashem. And therefore, it says in Chesed Abramsky, once Haman realized, even if I finally do get Mordechai to bow down, it's not going to change the fact. The Jews aren't going to bow down to me. They'll just realize that Mordechai wasn't as great as they thought he was. Then I will kill them all, because none of them are bowing down. Now, it's an interesting take on the story, which is why I'm mentioning it, but more importantly, it fits into our broader pattern. Okay, now let's go to the last two paragraphs, and here we will conclude this amazing, amazing piece. So he says here, you ready? Second to last paragraph. L'chein. Now we get back to the original question. How do we get into all this? Get fascinating, wide-ranging. As I said to you, I don't think I was exaggerating how important and how very foundational this whole essay is. But we started off with a very technical, narrow Purim question, which is, why is the holiday called Purim? Like, what a silly, incidental, technical, pre-story part of the story. So now he's going to, in light of all this, he comes back to it. Ulchein, Haman Samach Kshenafal HaPur Ba'adar. This is why the poor, the lottery, was so important, why Haman was so happy when he found out it was in Adar. Mishum Shiladato, he assumed, Kevin Shemes Moshe, Huklish Koach HaTorah Eitzel Yisrael. It wasn't like we usually think, and the way I said it 30 minutes ago, that when he found out that the lottery was on Adar, ooh, if Moshe died in Adar, it's a bad omen. No, it was deeper than that. He figured, it must be that when Moshe died, he was their leader. And when they saw that he wasn't so holy, but in fact he's a human being, from dust to dust, even he died, that probably, he assumed, weakened their belief, weakened their faith. Aval ta'ah, but he made a mistake. Sha'adarabah! Zesemes! The very fact that Moshe died, Heresh Shigam Nolad. If he could die like a human being, it means he was also born as a human being. Ha'inushu yalud isha k'chol anashim. He was born from a mother. He was conceived the way every other child in history has been conceived. And despite the fact that he came from a very normal, simple, biological beginning of a husband and a wife, he rose to such unprecedented heights of being the father of all prophets. Again, he's not saying that everyone could be Moshe, but each person on their own level can achieve greatness. Everyone can be great. That's the deeper meaning when he thought Moshe died in Adar, meaning, oh, probably the Torah got weak because once they saw that their leader wasn't divine, they probably kind of weakened the whole thing. But they didn't realize that Moshe was born in Adar. So we said, oh, that means it's a good omen. Says Moshe, no. Both what Haman thought and his mistake are on a deeper level. He thought that philosophically, theologically, it would weaken them. But on the contrary, says Rav Moshe, the fact that Moshe was born, died in Adar, meaning he was born in Adar, that is to say, it was in Adar that we realized that even Moshe is just human. Even Moshe was flesh and blood like the rest of us. Even Moshe was conceived like the rest of us. And therefore, there's no reason for us to have any less faith the day after Moshe died from the day before. Misaso lo hiktina chasa shalom inyan haTorah etzleinu. When Moshe Rabbeinu died, it did not mean that any person had even an ounce less of religious devotion. On the contrary, od higdila mitam deviarti. On the contrary, if anything, it reinforced. If Moshe can die, that means he was born. That means he was human. And look what he accomplished. Look what I can accomplish. So not only did it not lessen their faith, if anything, it gave them motivation to be greater. Now you realize, now he doesn't mean you only rely on yourself. He's not saying, you know, don't have rabbis or don't have parents or don't have role models. What he means to say is, there's no vicarious religion. Judaism does not believe in vicarious observance. Right? And I've spoken about this in the past. Adabra el kol b'nei Yisrael, right? Kadoshim to you. Why is it called Adas b'nei Yisrael? Because everyone has to be holy, because everyone can be holy. People make that mistake, right? The men think, I have a Yitzhahara, I have challenges as a man, my wife will be holy. The women say, that's my husband's job. He'll learn Torah, he'll go to shul. And everyone thinks, the rabbi will be holy. That'll be enough for both of us. And it's all a mistake. Says Rav Moshe, Tzarech lismoch rak al atzmo. There's no vicarious religion. There's no vicarious observance. We're all responsible for ourselves. Me'achar shirosh afat tzadikim meisim. Anyone can die because anyone's human. Imkein tzarech lirosh yu b'chol dorat tzadikim v'tamin ha'chamim ma'achirim. And therefore, we're responsible as a community. We're responsible as a nation to make sure that not only each of us ourselves are good, but we need other leaders. Leaders play a role, but they're going to come and go because they're human. Therefore, each generation is responsible for creating a new generation of leadership. And that responsibility, each generation feels to be that sheres apleta, to continue. Right? I know it went, I can't remember where he was asked. Was it an NTSY event or a YU event? But it kind of went viral within the last few months, and I even saw it recently reposted again on social media, where I can't remember the context, but they asked Rav Herschel Schechter, who needless to say has had a few accomplishments in his life, they asked him, what is he most proud of? Right? Author of who knows how many Svarim, thousands of Talmidim, thousands of... you can't even put into one, you know, a few words how much he's accomplished. And he said, without batting an eye, I am most proud of the fact that I've raised a religious family and that I'm another link in the chain of tradition. Period. So pasuk. That's what he's most proud of, he said. Something that any one of us hopefully can hopefully say about ourselves when we reach 80, like he was, I think, when he was asked that question. Right, so that's exactly what Rav Moshe is saying in this last line. We're all responsible to do that. But we feel that responsibility because we know that the people who came before us, they also were once upon a time kids. Those people that we look up to, once upon a time, they were the Dor Yosom who said, oh my gosh, how are we going to do it? Our leaders, our Rebbeim died. Well, they figured out a way to make new Rebbeim and new leaders. Well, now it's our responsibility. It's now our generation. So it's actually empowering. And now we come to the last paragraph. Ulachein. And therefore, that's why Haman was wrong. And back in the day, in the time of the end of the desert, in Zos HaBracha, when Moshe dies after 40 years in the desert, it wasn't a loss of faith. They were sad, they mourned, they missed Moshe, but they didn't lose their faith. V'nimsa shehapur, shenafel ba'adar. So when Haman's lottery fell on the month of Adar, this was because of Haman's mistake. He thought mistakenly that we're not so strong in our faith and our commitment, and therefore Yuchal ben Akel abed at Shema Yudim. And he thought, oh, you see, just like Moshe died, and that probably weakened the Jewish people, so for sure the people are easily for me. I can easily, you know, take them out. Says Rav Moshe, but he didn't realize. Adarabba, Hanesh Shalano. That in fact was the greatest miracle for our survival. Moshe's death forced all of us to step up, forced us to take more responsibility, to remind us that we can't rely on a Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe is just like us, he's human. And now he says it's not only in Moshe Rabbeinu. Now he pivots very quickly to Tisha B'Av, right? And this is the question we speak about, we think about every year, especially on Tisha B'Av. How is it that we keep on surviving year after year? Right, what other nation has been able to survive the dispersion, the destruction of their first base of Megdash, the second base of Megdash, the golos that are being sent out? How is it that we keep on doing it? Like the Megillah describes, right? He uses poetic language. We're spread out in the diaspora. No, because each time we have a disappointment like that, just like we couldn't believe in vicarious religion that we can't live through a Moshe or can't live through a Mordechai, we also were reminded when the Beis Mikdash was destroyed that our whole religion is not based on a Beis Mikdash either. The relationship we have, when the Beis Mikdash is standing, of course, that's a very important part of our relationship with Hashem. But we don't worship the Beis Mikdash. Just like we don't worship Moshe or any other great person. We worship Hashem with the teachings of the great rabbi or through the Beis Mikdash. But we only worship one thing, Hashem. He was before the Beis HaMikdash, he'll be after the Beis HaMikdash, he's before Moshe was born, he's after Moshe died. And therefore, if we have that mentality, again, if all of your entire religious life was invested in the Beis HaMikdash, how do you survive when the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed? Again, it was obviously a huge trauma to them. And the adjustment from going from a life of karbonos to a life of davening or learning, I'm sure, traumatic, of course. Difficult. I don't know about you, everyone's different. And I don't think I'm the only one who kind of has changed over my lifetime, but I can't remember if I was always like this. But certainly as I've gotten older, I am noticing about myself, I am horrible when it comes to change. Like I keep on doing the same thing or have the same tchotchke or computer or whatever the thing would be. The idea of getting something new or having to change is like almost, I'm getting so stuck in my ways. I see it happening. I think I probably have had a little bit like this my whole life, but I notice it as I'm getting older, for sure. Right? So obviously, to change it, if it's hard for me to like change, which version of Microsoft I'm using, or to get a new phone, right? Like my phone's already a few years old. The battery doesn't last as long. It's fallen 17 times. Like I'm not getting a new phone. I can afford it. I get a new phone. But that would mean, you know what it would mean to get a new phone? I have to relearn where. What if it's not exactly the same? Oh my! It's just too much. I can't. I'd rather stick with this one. Right? So if that was true about my phone or some other Narishkeit, I can't even imagine if my whole life was, I had a base of Mikdash and now I had to learn how to deal without a base of Mikdash. So hard, yes. Of course. Moshe Rabbeinu dies or a leader disappoints you. Hard, yes. But a crisis of faith? It doesn't make sense anymore. Why should I believe anymore? No, there's no connection. If you're feeling that way, it means that you made a mistake way before. You were actually believing in the Beis HaMikdash, not serving Hashem through the Beis HaMikdash. You're believing in the rabbi, believing in the teacher, not just being inspired by or educated by the person. That mistake was the more foundational one. But if we have the right approach, then that gives us much more resilience. Because even though it may be difficult to change, and it's certainly always painful to be disappointed in life, and the more we love or the more we trust it, the more painful it is, obviously, but it doesn't present necessarily a crisis of faith. And therefore he says, that's why last two lines, Yefsher la'abdo mi'achsha Torah hinitzchit. What we believe in is one thing, Hashem and the Torah, and that is eternal. And therefore the Jewish people, as long as we remain faithful to that and not the other things, we will remain eternal. V'chozman shi kayemet am Yisrael kayam, as long as there's a Torah, Hashem, there'll be a Jewish people, shu l'netzach netzachim. And therefore, ending where we started, last line, v'ninsa sheshem purim, and now we understand why the lottery was so important and why it's called Purim. Because in essence, what he's saying is one of the most important, if not the central, subtle, but clearly central theme of the story is a battle of worldviews. Why was... He's not answering the question of why Haman chose to use a lottery. That you have a lot of Amalek Torah and chance versus Hashkacha. He didn't get into any of that stuff. That wasn't really what he was asking. What he was asking is, why do we call the holiday Purim? And the answer, says Rav Moshe, is because what made Haman so excited when the lottery fell on Adar was based on his view of the world, his theological prism through which he viewed the world, which is that, broadly speaking, again, he's kind of identifying with a kind of Christian, if you will, approach, which is that there are holy people, they represent God, and it's not nearly as important what we do, and therefore, if they make mistakes, either the whole thing is a crock anyway, or maybe we're allowed to make the same mistakes, because it's all about, as opposed to what he didn't realize is it wasn't that Moshe died then, and therefore, in Adar, and therefore we really lost our faith because we believed in Moshe. Rather, the effect is in Adar, Moshe was born. The poor, which could have been our downfall because it was showing that we have a weaker commitment, and if all Haman had to do was squeeze a little bit, and we'd let go. After all, Moshe died, so we must not have such faith anymore in that month. But what he didn't realize, says Rav Moshe, is that the whole essence of Judaism can be found in the fact that Moshe was born and died in the month of Adar. Because all of that highlights this broader point, which is that he was a human being, and as a human being, he was great. That itself inspires us, because if he could be great, why can I be great? And it also insulates us, if God forbid Moshe would have failed by making a mistake, which he did sin. Not on the level that we were alluding to before, but still, he did sin. And number two is, throughout history, when other disappointments happen, if we realize we're not believing in any of those things, certainly not any other human being, that's for sure, even any other object, but rather in Hashem and the Torah, so then that insulates us and gives us more resilience. Any questions on this? As you may have been able to tell, I like this piece. I think this is really, really important. I don't think I oversold it. I wasn't sure how long it would take. It took almost the entire shiur, but I think personally, I think it was worth it. Okay, if no one has any questions on that, we'll just turn over the page and we're not going to be able to do the bigger piece from Rav Asher Weiss, although that was a great piece too. Those of you who want to try to go through it on your own, that's fine. But I will, let's just do, we have a few more minutes, so let's just do the small piece on top of the second page, and this is from the Bnei Yisachar. The Bnei Yisachar was one of the earlier Hasidic giants, known as the Dinever. And he has a book, the Bnei Yisachar is written on the months. It's kind of on the holidays, I guess you could say, to a large extent, but it's arranged by month. A lot of the Hasidic Sfarim that you're more familiar with, like the Sfas Emes or Nesiva Shalom, are often, Nesiva Shalom has a lot of things actually, but the classical Hasidic Sfarim that are more popular are often based on Parshios. Or something like the Balatanya, which is just a philosophical Hasidic work. But the Bnei Yisrael is written based on months. So obviously when you're going by months, he's often talking about holidays or things in the calendar. So he makes the following. And the background, which he's going to allude to in like one parenthesis, in the beginning of the first line, so I'll say it outside, something which is not relevant this year, but has been relevant in recent years, which is what happens if you have a leap year? Two Adars. Is that last year? Yeah, last year, right? I'm still traumatized by it. Makes the Zman much longer for yeshiva and mess up the your summer plans, whatever. Anyway, I'm not saying I should be traumatized by it, but as I already confessed to you, change is hard for me. Two Adars, oh my gosh. Anyway, so the question in halacha is, if you have two Adar, right, you agree?
No, I'm saying it happens often.
Yeah, I know, it's hard.
It's always hard.
Anyway. One of my mentors once was making fun, Rabbi Luchstein. He said, people every year, especially before Shana Yom Kippur, they always ask themselves, are the Yom Tovim early this year? Are the Yom Tovim late this year? He says, no, they're on time.
Yeah,
they're always the same dates. You think it's early, you think it's late. It's the same, it's on time. Okay, anyway, so when you have two Adars, when is Purim? Should Purim be the first Adar or the second Adar? So we know what we do. You and I know the practical conclusion. But in the Gemara, they weren't sure. The Gemara raises the question and gives different arguments why it should be the first Adar, or different arguments why it should be the second Adar. What is the argument that the Gemara gives for why Purim should be celebrated in the second Adar, which is ultimately the argument that is accepted, because that is what we do. We celebrate Purim in the second Adar. So if you look at the first line of that source, says he's quoting the Gemara here, we want to have the holiday of Purim to be mismach geula legeula, right? Purim was a redemption, a salvation of the Jewish people from Haman, from Achashverosh. Pesach is a redemption, a salvation of the Jewish people from Egypt, saving us from Paro. And therefore, since they're both similar themes of redemption and salvation, says the Gemara, we want to have this association, we want to have one leading into the other, we want to have that break. Mismach geula legeula. We're going to have a smichut, a connection, association between the one geula of Purim going into the geula of Pesach. And that is the argument why, and the reason why, Purim is in the second Adar. So says the Bnei Yisachar, okay, that's just a very technical, nice idea, fine. But he puts a deeper Hasidic spin on it. Second line. Hainu, lismoch inyan ha-hashkacha v'ha-geula ha-nisteret le-geula ha-niglit. Says the Bnei Yisachar, Purim and Pesach don't just happen to be two stories of redemption and salvation. They are that, but much more than that, they are paradigms for two different types. Two different types or two different forms of redemption. What was the nature of the redemption on Pesach? Right? You read the Pesukim, let alone the Medrash, let alone if you have one of those children Haggadahs. Like this whole story you didn't even know about. Right, some of those pictorial ten makos. Whoa, wow! I don't know what was going on. Alligators and all sorts of crazy stuff going on. Right, those are my kids' favorite haggadahs. Okay, but and they're always, and I to them credit, they're always a quoting in a footnote somewhere, some medrash that they found, that says these. Right, all of those things climaxing, of course, with the splitting of the Yamsuf. That was clearly, says the Bnei Sasfar, an example of a very revealed salvation, right? If you were going through that, there was no one doubting that it was but the hand of God. This is miraculous, this was divine intervention, this is not normal stuff. Purim, as we know famously, completely different. Hashem's name, God's name, isn't even in the Megillah. Now, of course, we believe that God is choreographing everything, but it's behind the scenes. He didn't split the sea and drown Haman in it. It was palace intrigue. Right? Esther manipulated Achashverosh like Machiavelli couldn't have been more proud. right? It was brilliant the way she manipulates him, and she uses her feminine guile, and she sets up Haman, and she inflates his ego by inviting him, and Mordechai just happened to be there, and he overheard. There's a lot of coincidence, there's a lot of political intrigue, a lot of power moving and, you know, calculated, you know, strategy. Where's God? And the answer, of course, is that we believe that all of this was just being choreographed, what we call a hidden miracle or a hidden hashkacha. Sometimes God will involve himself in the world in a very transparent way, and other times in a hidden way. This, we've discussed this in the past, this is not only, but maybe most famously associated with the Ramban. The Ramban at the end of Parshat Bo and in other places, but the Ramban in a very lengthy and important piece there, we just read it a few weeks ago in Kriyat HaTorah, Parshas Bo. So he talks about how there's two types. There's Nes Nigla, the revealed miracle, the transparent, the obvious time that God's involved in the world, and the hidden miracles, the Nes Nistar. So says the Bnei Yisachar, that's not just true in general. The paradigm of these two are Pesach as the transparent revealed miracle and Purim as the hidden divine involvement. And therefore, it's very important, he says, we see from this Gemara, Mismach Gula Le'ula. We want to have Purim and Pesach next to each other. Right? Because that teaches us what? That El Achad Bar'an. Yotzer Echad Yatzran. Because it's the same God. You shouldn't think that in some medieval or ancient sense there's different gods. And you also shouldn't forget that the Purim story is also God. The same God who did Pesach is the same one who, in a hidden, subtle way, is doing Purim. The Zen Nirmaz Beremez. And now he adds, first of all, that's itself just a great idea. And then he says something really, really cute and clever. Again, it's hard to, it's not pshat, but it is very interesting and cute and clever and inspirational. And soon enough, we'll say a Hallel, although not on Purim, that's all, but we'll say Hallel on Rosh Chodesh Adar, or next Yontif on Pesach. And remember this. So he says, this is what is hinted at in Hallel. Because what do we say? Ana Hashem Hoshiana. Or Ana Hashem Hatzlichana. Now what are we saying? Please God, save us. Please God, make us successful. But why is the last word na? So he says clearly in a very cutesy kind of way, and that's why he puts the, if you have the, if you're looking inside, he puts it in quotation marks, not the word nun aleph, but he plays around with it, he adds the quote marks, nun aleph, because he says, what is that really cutesy allusion to? Rashi Tevos, nun aleph, Nisan Adar. Again, I never thought about this when I was actually saying the words, but I will now. Again, it's not really pshat in the Pasuk in Tehillim or Hallel, but it's a kind of cutesy idea. And why is that? Hainu, what are we saying? Hoshia, v'hatzlicha, v'shtei hanhagot hein hanhagat nisei nisan, haneglaim, and nisei adar hanistar. We're asking Hashem every month, every time we say Hallel, every yontif, we're asking Hashem to continue in our personal lives, in our national lives, to be there for us, to be there for the Jewish people, just like he was in Nisan, with revealed miracles. Just like he was in Adar, in Purim, in the hidden miracles. Hoshia na, like you did in Nisan and Adar. Haslicha na, like you did in Nisan and Adar. Very, very beautiful. I didn't mean to be irreverent when I called it cutesy. Cutesy can be reverential. Again, just certainly not rigorously pshat, I would say, would be a fair way of explaining this. But nevertheless, the overall idea, I think, is really quite deep and quite moving. And that is that it's not a coincidence that we want to have Purim always butting up against Pesach. In a typical year, we have it anyway. But even in a leap year, we move Purim to the later one, even though there's good reasons to have done it in the first one. We always want to have Purim and Pesach next to each other so that we don't forget. It's easy to just forget about Hashem. There's so many fun things to do in Purim. It's easy to forget about Hashem. Right? In Yom Kippur, you have nothing else to think about but like Hashem and your relationship. Right? And other holidays, it's somewhere in the middle. But Purim is the extreme opposite. Right? Which is that there's so much revelry, you don't even mention him in any book, you know, in the Megillah. You could easily go through Purim and forget Hashem. But we always have Purim next to Pesach to remind us that there are two different ways that God mediates his relationship with us, two different ways he interacts with us. Now again, you know, inquiring minds want to know why sometimes is he this way, why sometimes is he that way. You know, every now and then, you know, maybe a little bit of a sign, a little bit of a Pesach now would be good, God. And he hasn't listened to me in a while. But doesn't mean I haven't gotten a lot of Purim salvations. But you know the Pesach salvations are far and few between. So why God decided to run the world the way he does, that's an answer that you need to ask someone on a higher pay scale than me. But the fact that there are these two different ways, And the Purim and Pesach represent these two different paradigms, and therefore that's why they need to be next to each other so we don't forget, we don't lose out that lesson. That's a very interesting idea and adds another layer of meaning to Purim. So we had a chance to go through two pieces, not three, but we did go through two, one very, very big one and one short one, and I hope they will both enrich your Purim celebration. You're welcome.